From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, investigating the shady partnerships that helped lead to the collapse of Enron. We talk with Wall Street Journal reporters Rebecca Smith and John Emschweiler. They broke the story of the partnerships. Their new book, 24 Days, chronicles their experiences covering the Enron story. Also, we talk with satirist Bill Maher about politics, comedy, and his HBO series, Real Time. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The first American troops arrived in Liberia today to help a West African peacekeeping force. NPR's Jason Beaubien reports.
The very first U.S. troops that are going to be involved in this peacekeeping operation arrived via Black Hawk helicopters. They were flown into the U.S. embassy, and then they quickly were whisked out to the airport where Nigerian troops are setting up a base that's going to be the sort of command center for this peacekeeping operation in Liberia. These seven are expected to play an advisory role. They're expected to help with logistics, to help with communications, to help with essentially running a peacekeeping operation like this. Eventually, there may be some other Marines that are involved, but it's going to be a very limited number of U.S. troops that are here on the ground participating in this peacekeeping operation.
NPR's Jason Beaubien in Monrovia. The United Nations is asking countries to donate $69 million in emergency aid for Liberia. Israel has released more than 300 Palestinian prisoners in a move Israel describes as a goodwill gesture and Palestinians say is inadequate. NPR's Linda Gradstein has more from Jerusalem.
The nearly 340 prisoners were taken by bus to checkpoints in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Once they were let off the buses, their handcuffs were removed. Some bent to kiss the ground, while others were welcomed by happy relatives waving flags. More than 180 of the men are security prisoners, while more than 150 are administrative detainees, meaning they were held without charges or trial. Another 99 prisoners, mostly criminals and Palestinians who were caught without permits in Israel, will be released in the coming days. Palestinian officials criticized the release, saying many more of the thousands of detainees in Israeli jails should have been freed. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The U.S. military is preparing to resume its anti-narcotics flights in and around Colombia. The flights have been suspended since 2001 when a Peruvian fighter jet, acting on information from U.S. intelligence, shot down an American missionary plane, killing an American woman and child. General James Hill, the commander of the U.S. Southern Command, says the new flights would have safeguards to prevent such incidents.
We are very confident that the checklists and the procedures that we've developed will preclude the horrific tragedy that occurred a couple years ago in Peru. And if we weren't that way, we wouldn't be signing an agreement. We wouldn't be asking the President of the United States to sign up for it.
The White House is expected to announce the resumption of the flights tomorrow. Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow gained 25 points to close at 9,061 in active trading. The Nasdaq lost 20 points to close at 1,652. This is NPR News. William Bulger resigned today as president of the University of Massachusetts. Bulger's been under pressure to resign since he testified in the federal investigation of his brother Whitey, a fugitive on the FBI's most wanted list. Critics have accused William Bulger of withholding information to protect his brother, who disappeared in 1995. Scientists in Italy say they've produced the world's first cloned horse. NPR's Joe Palca has more.
The foal was born on May 28th. Her name is Promethea. She's a European breed of horse called a halflinger. To make Promethea, scientists with the Italian company CIZ used eggs retrieved from slaughterhouses. They removed the DNA from those eggs and replaced it with DNA taken from skin cells of an adult horse. They then coaxed the eggs to start growing in the laboratory. After 7 days, they transferred the healthy embryos they got to a mare's uterus. In a peculiar quirk, the mare that donated the DNA to clone Promethea was also the birth mother, so in this case, mother and daughter are genetic twins. A report on the Italian cloning effort appears in the journal Nature. The horse is not the first equine to be cloned. Earlier this year, scientists in Utah cloned a mule. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
A Portland, Oregon man pleaded guilty today to a charge of aiding the Taliban. Maher Mike Hawash, a computer software engineer, made the plea as part of a bargain with federal prosecutors who agreed to drop other charges against him, including conspiring to make war against the United States. Hawash will serve at least 7 years in prison. He's agreed to testify against other members of the so-called Portland Seven, a group of people accused of trying to go to Afghanistan to help the Taliban. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Harper Business, publisher of The Intelligent Investor by Benjamin Graham, Principles for Value Investing, newly updated by Jason Zweig and with a preface by Warren Buffett.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are two Wall Street Journal reporters who broke significant parts of the Enron story. John Emshwiler and Rebecca Smith have written a book that chronicles the collapse of Enron and describes their experiences investigating the story. The book is called 24 Days. That's a reference to the time between October 16, 2001, when Enron released its third quarter report, which showed a $618 million loss, and November 8th, when Enron filed its own report with the SEC, laying out an array of misdeeds, hidden deals, and bogus accounting. Emshwiler and Smith were ahead of the story. They'd started investigating Enron in mid-August after the surprise resignation of Enron's CEO, Jeff Skilling. The reporters uncovered shady partnerships that helped explain Enron's massive losses. They published the first of their investigative articles October 17th, the day after the release of Enron's disastrous earnings report. You started working on the Enron story after the sudden resignation of the CEO, Jeff Skilling. Why wasn't his resignation just business as usual? CEO resigns, big deal, another CEO resigning.
Well, it wasn't business as usual, Terry, because Jeff Skilling was not your average CEO. We're talking about a man who was at the head of a company that had been an absolute juggernaut in corporate America. And he had worked his way to the top, some might say clawed his way to the top over a 10-year period. And yet, here suddenly in August of 2001, he suddenly and inexplicably quits, citing personal reasons. No one knew of any personal reasons. So that raised questions immediately.
Well, you called the publicist for Enron, who kind of said, yeah, personal reasons. And then you got an interview with Skilling himself. What did he tell you that raised more doubts in your mind?
Yeah, well, I did the interview the day after he quit. And it was the strangest interview I've ever done, probably as a reporter with a senior executive of a major company. And it was as much as what he said, it was sort of how he said it. He sounded like a depressed man who was given to long sort of rambling sentences, almost speaking to himself. I was barely asking any questions. And instead of talking about personal reasons, which he sort of started with, he starts talking, as again, almost to himself about the stock price of Enron's stock, which had been falling like much of the stock market for the past 12 months or so. And, you know, he kept telling himself, well, if the stock price only stayed up, it would be okay. And then at one point he said, you know, I'd still be there. It'd be all right. And I sort of stopped him and said, excuse me, Mr. Skilling, are you saying that if the stock price hadn't fallen, you wouldn't have resigned? And there was this kind of pause. And he said, and really almost like a little boy's voice, he said, yeah, I guess so. And we're thinking, well, guy, we got a story here. But nothing else, the man's contradicted the official line from the day before. So, as I say, it was a very strange interview that raised some questions about, at least about what was going on with Skilling, and maybe something then, you know, the question would be going on at Enron. And that same day, we made a second discovery that sort of also whetted our interest about the company and what was going on inside.
What was that discovery?
Well, that was when, as I was sort of preparing for the interview with Skilling, what we often do at the Journal is you go back and read, like, some recent filing the company made with the Securities and Exchange Commission, which all big companies, public companies, have to periodically file with the SEC about their financial results and what's been going on at the company. And as I read their most recent filing, I came across a section that's always there called Related Party Transactions, which usually is about deals that company executives or directors have with the company itself, sort of the dirty laundry list sometimes about, you know, if a director has a consulting contract or the nephew of the chairman has a vice presidential post, they got to put that in related party transactions. And the ones for Enron, I'd never seen anything like it before. And I'd been reading these things for a fairly long time as a journal reporter. And they're talking about these unnamed partnerships run by some unnamed senior executive officer that seemed to be doing hundreds of millions of dollars of business with Enron. You couldn't quite tell from the gobbledygook they put out in this footnote what exactly the deals, what impact they're having on Enron, but it seemed obviously very suspicious. Here you had some senior official, you had big amounts of business, and these partnerships. So the first thing I did that day was to call the head of PR for Enron, because my first assumption was, well, maybe that's Jeff Skilling they're talking about. Maybe that's why he resigned.
But you found out that it wasn't Jeff Skilling who was running these partnerships. It was actually
Andy Fastow,
who is the chief financial officer of Enron. What were the clues that you found that revealed that it was Fastow?
Well, the funny thing, of course, is that he was unnamed in that report. But if you went back to earlier footnotes and earlier reports, every so often under the law, they had to name the related party. And once a year at Enron, they did. They also, when you called them, the Enron said, oh, that was Andy Fastow, because, you know, I was thinking it's Jeff Skilling, and they wanted to, you know, disabuse me of that notion. And so we find out it's Fastow. They say, oh, these are perfectly legitimate. They've been going on for 2 years. Nothing to worry about. But we thought there was something to worry about. We thought they were at least strange and that they're at least worth mentioning in the paper, which we subsequently did, make a mention of these partnerships in the paper. And then that led to a phone call that Rebecca got.
Rebecca, before we talk about the phone call, why were you so concerned about the partnership? Why was the idea that the CFO was running these partnerships a conflict of interest in your mind?
Well, because Andy Fastow, as the CFO, had a sworn fiduciary duty to put the interests of investors ahead of his own interests. And yet here he was running partnerships that were conducting vast sums of business with the company, and it appeared to John and I that he was making millions of dollars off of this relationship. And in fact, you know, this is the sort of thing that you would have expected the Enron board to have said, no way, you cannot do that. That's a violation of your fiduciary duty.
So these partnerships were separate businesses that he was profiting from that might not have been in the best interests of the stockholders?
Yeah, what we knew at the beginning was, as Becky's mentioned, is that, you know, you had these separate entities, and Andy Fastow was running them and, according to the SEC filings, had a part ownership interest in them. And they were doing lots of business with Enron, where he was the CFO. So, you know, if you have a business transaction between two sides, you know, the two sides are always trying to get the most they can for their side. The problem is you had Andy Fastow on one side as the head of the partnership and Andy Fastow on the other side as the CFO of Enron, and he couldn't get the best deal for both of them. Somebody's interest had to get lost in that. You know, somebody might come out better in the negotiations because you had Andy on both sides. So he had a situation where, like, it was just a built-in conflict.
Except that early on, in the period you're talking about here, Terry, we didn't actually know what was being done with these partnerships exactly. All we knew was that there was something going on that looked nefarious and looked like a violation of what are considered just basic bedrock conflict of interest rules.
Well, Rebecca, let's get back to that call that you got that gave you more clues.
Right. Well, we put what we knew in a story that ran in the journal, which is called Heard on the Street. And we really didn't know very much about these partnerships. We actually quoted from one of the Securities and Exchange Commission filings to show how convoluted and arcane and gobbledygookish was Enron's explanation. And we were hoping that it might shake loose some additional information, which it did, because right after that column ran, I received a phone call from someone saying, hey, the story was good, but basically you don't know the half of it. Call me if you would like to learn a little bit more. And I did, and had several conversations with that person, who turned out to be a treasure trove of information, because this person had internal documents that really mapped out for us what it was that Andy Fastow was doing with these partnerships and how he was putting his own interests and the interests of his separate investors ahead of that of Enron.
And the irony, in a way, is that, you know, we were, if it hadn't been for that call, Rebecca and I made this one story and put out this mention of these partnerships, thinking at the very least it was worth putting on the record in the newspaper like the Journal. But I think both of us were planning, if we didn't get much reaction, we'd just go on and go on to other stories because we didn't have any other place to go with the information that we had about the partnerships. And Fastow had resigned from the partnerships 2 weeks earlier, for unexplained reasons. But so this call was really critical because otherwise, you know, we might have just let the story go and moved on and dropped it.
What did these partnerships do? What kind of businesses were they?
Well, basically, there were two partnerships, both of them called LJM. They came to be known LJM-1, LJM-2. And as we learned later, the LJM were the initials of Fastow's wife and two sons. And basically what they were done is they were set up to protect Enron from having to report losses in its various investments that were going sour. And so what Andy Fastow would do is he'd go out and get outside investors. He'd get usually big institutions that did business with Enron and therefore had some reason to want to keep Enron happy.
Oftentimes banks.
Banks. And or investment banks that did business with Enron. They'd put in money in the LJM-2 partnership. They put in close to $400 million. And that money would then be used to help set up various transactions with Enron. They'd set up like a third entity. So Enron would be there, LJM-2. They'd set up another entity. And they'd stuff basically Enron stock into the entity. And then they'd stuff Enron's bad investments into the entity and basically use the value of the stock to hide the losses in the other investments through some complex accounting transactions. But you needed that outside party like LJM-2 to make the accountant satisfied that this really could be taken off of Enron's books.
Well, let me quote the kind of report that you had to read in order to figure out what the heck was happening. Here's one of the Enron reports, and you quote from this in your book. It's an earnings report that referred to $544 million in, quote, related losses associated with certain investments, principally Enron's interest in the new power company, broadband technology investments, and early termination during the third quarter of certain structured finance arrangements with a previously disclosed entity. What? Certain structured finance arrangements with a previously disclosed entity. I mean, what does that mean?
You see, this is why you're in a black box, and that's what these so-called disclosures showed. There's no way reading that to know what on earth they're talking about. We didn't know. The equities analysts didn't know. And this is why it really required documents from the inside to explain what are these transactions and what are these entities, because it was very complicated.
Yeah, essentially what those entities were, we learned, they were talking there about four entities that all went under the name the Raptors. And those entities were essentially used to help produce on paper for Enron over $1 billion of pre-tax income in like a two-year period, roughly nearly half of all the reported income they had for that period. And you wouldn't know that until you got deep into Enron what was going on. So they just had these kind of like meaningless code words that they could say their lawyers would tell them, okay, that satisfies your disclosure requirement. You said something, even though it doesn't mean anything to the average investor or even the very sophisticated investor on the outside. But that's sort of what Enron had evolved into, that it was sort of trying to meet the letter of the law as interpreted by themselves, their lawyers, and their accountants, without ever giving any sense of what was really happening at the company.
My guests are Wall Street Journal reporters John Emshweiler and Rebecca Smith, authors of the new book 24 Days, about their experiences investigating the Enron story. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Rebecca Smith and John Emshweiler. They're the authors of the new book, 24 Days. They both report for the Wall Street Journal, and they broke several key parts of the Enron story. At some point during your investigation, you decided you needed to speak to the people at the top of Enron. So you talked to Enron's PR guy, and he told you that he wanted your questions written in advance, and then he would submit the questions, and they would decide what to do. And you complied. You wrote 21, you know, pretty tough questions. Why did you comply with that? You could have said, I'm sorry, we don't do that. We don't give questions in advance. We want the interview. Well, we're not going to tell you what the questions are.
This is something actually John and I debated some because we had a difference of opinion. I felt that in the questions we submitted, we tipped our hand too much. I felt we showed too much of what we had. But an argument could be made, and it was a strong one that John made, that we're going to have to, they're going to know everything we have in the end anyway. We might as well tell it to them now, let them respond now. My fear was that this would then, they would be less inclined to respond because they would be sort of frightened of the amount of information that appeared that had come to us.
And that seems to be what happened. They didn't give you the interview.
Well, yeah, they didn't give us the interview. And I still don't think it was a mistake because I think, you know, as Becky said, we're going to have to give them the questions anyway. It has become a much more common tactic in corporate America to ask for questions in advance. I've never felt constrained to, you know, one, to give them all my questions or to, you know, you just the questions you get. I also found that, you know, in some ways their silence was more eloquent than if they had given us interviews because Enron had this reputation for being very confident, almost to the point of being cocky in dealing with the press, that they were always available, that they were always, you know, because they thought they had such a great story and a great ability to tell the story that they were happy to bring in reporters and just overwhelm them with information and certitude. When they actually came back and refused to talk to us, that in as much perhaps as anything, told me that there was something much bigger inside of Enron about these partnerships.
Would you have handled this episode differently in retrospect? You know, if you could do it over again, would you have submitted those questions in advance?
Yeah, I don't actually think it made much difference. I don't think Enron, as I look back on it, was going to talk.
Well, I think that we made a tactical error in submitting such detailed questions. Would it have made a difference in the end? Probably not. But I do think that we might have elicited a little more information on the LJM partnerships early on. But again, in the long run, I don't think it would have mattered.
Are there any Enron executives that have yet faced any punishment?
No one has. I mean, several people have been charged with crimes. A couple have pleaded guilty. No one has actually had to stand trial yet.
But that's not so unusual, really, because, you know, big, complex, especially white-collar crime investigations can take years. I think, you know, it was 3 years plus before the Justice Department, Rudy Giuliani, and the SEC brought their case and closed it out against Mike Milken back in the 80s and the, you know, the great insider trading scandals of Wall Street. And in some ways, Enron is far more complex than what, you know, Drexel and the other big firms were doing back in the 80s. So, I mean, it's going to take them a while.
I know some skeptics think that the reason why it's taking a long time is because Kenneth Lay has close connections with President Bush, and because all the execs at Enron were so wealthy that maybe they could buy a more favorable form of justice for themselves.
Well, they can certainly hire expensive lawyers, and to the degree that helps them, you know, manipulate the process. I guess that's the same is true for all rich people. I actually think that at this point, Ken Lay's connection to the Bushes works against him because he's now in the worst of all positions in a way. George Bush can no longer take campaign donations from Ken Lay. So in that sense, Ken Lay's useless to George Bush, the politician. And at the same time, I don't think Bush wants to have to take the heat for saying, oh, yeah, we couldn't find a case against my old friend Ken Lay. If anything, I would suspect, you know, the Justice Department folks, if they were told anything by the White House, would be to, well, if you've turned over all the rocks on Ken Lay, turn them over again to make sure before we have to make the admission we're not going to bring a case against Ken.
But I think the main thing that's helping Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling and others right now is the sheer complexity of the financial structure that was developed, because a prosecutor knows that if they bring a case, they've got to be able to explain it to a jury. And, you know, they went after Arthur Anderson for obstruction of justice and very nearly lost that case. And it was, in comparison, child's play. It was such a simple case in comparison with what we're talking about with these other transactions.
And in retrospect, and one of the more astonishing things about the Enron saga might turn out to be how little of it was illegal. Because, you know, one of the things the prosecutors are running up against in Enron is that so many of these transactions, these off-balance sheet deals that look so scummy, had been approved by Arthur Andersen, the outside auditor, and the attorneys that looked over them. And that's a very potent defense in a criminal case. If an executive can say, well, my outside experts told me it was okay to do, it's very hard for a prosecutor to get over that.
What are the legal charges against the Enron executives now?
Well, there's a variety of charges, mostly related to fraud, conspiracy, money laundering, obstruction of justice.
Wire fraud.
Yeah, so they've used these various, sort of categories of crimes to then, discuss the specific acts of individuals. Andy Fastow so far has the largest array of charges against him. I think his superseding indictment now includes 109 counts. Now, some of those are, repeat crimes. They repeat different counts of the same kind of crime, say money laundering. But basically those kinds of things. So it runs a fairly wide gamut.
There are some who've been accused of wrongful acts in connection with these partnerships and others with wrongful acts related to the California energy crisis and trading type infractions.
So the partnerships, the trading, and then there's a sort of a third group now emerging where they've related to Enron's broadband operation, where they're basically charging senior executives of that unit with having lied to the public about the financial condition and business prospects of that unit while making large amounts of money selling Enron stock, of their own stock. So you've got these three different areas that are kind of mining the federal government, and there may well be others as they start looking at other senior executives, as well as, of course, the two most senior executives still out there would be Lay and Skilling.
John Emshweiler and Rebecca Smith are the authors of the new book, 24 Days. They write for The Wall Street Journal. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Pink Slip, a novel about love, work, and family by Rita Cerisi, author of Remind Me Again Why I Married You. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Bill Maher about politics, comedy, and his HBO series Real Time. And we continue our conversation about the collapse of Enron with Wall Street Journal reporters Rebecca Smith and John Emshweiler.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Wall Street Journal reporters John Emschweiler and Rebecca Smith. They broke the story of Enron's shady partnerships, which helped lead to the collapse of Enron. In their new book, 24 Days, Emschweiler and Smith chronicle their experiences investigating the Enron story. How would you say Enron relates, if at all, to the movement to recall Governor Gray Davis in California?
I think that, you know, one of the things that Gray Davis is accused of was flubbing the energy crisis. And there's no question but what earlier intervention by his administration might have made the crisis less severe. But he did what government officials and bureaucrats often do with something unfamiliar. They decide they're going to study it and study it, and he studied it to death. Meanwhile, it was spinning out of control. So from that standpoint, I think there is some culpability. But in a larger sense, what we now know is that there was a flawed market structure in California that was exacerbated tremendously by entities like Enron and other traders that were trying to exploit every opening that they could find. And certainly Gray Davis is not responsible for the fact that they didn't care how much money they were able to suck out of the system. They were going to go for it. And they didn't care if in the end it ruined a market.
A lot of people, a lot of readers of the Wall Street Journal feel like the investigative staff of the paper reveals things in its investigations that contradict the position of the editorial page.
We hope so.
So I'm wondering where you think Enron fits into that. I mean, you helped uncover this incredibly corrupt, really large organization that, you know, shareholders lost money. People who worked for Enron lost money. It reveals the really ugly side of capitalism. Capitalism has gone really astray. So what's the difference, do you think, between what you saw in your investigation and what the editorial pages ended up saying or what they had said before?
Well, I think the editorial pages, you know, they're obviously great champions of American capitalism and great, you know, disparagers of government regulation of American capitalism. But to give them their due, I think they were fairly hard when Enron came down. They were especially hard, for instance, on the banks, who they thought were these kind of corrupt enablers, as I read some of our editorials. Because they think, you know, their feeling would be at least stated is that, well, you know, when capitalism is a great thing, but when bad things happen, the market has to correct it. The market has to, you know, wreak its, you know, sort of justice on the wrongdoers. And so I would assume they think, you know, Enron should be punished, but it doesn't say something more fundamental about the system of the marketplace. Whereas other people look at it and might say, well, yeah, it says something about the marketplace and why we need to regulate the marketplace in certain ways in order to restrain the, you know, sort of the more cowboy parts of capitalism.
But one of the tenets, of course, of market capitalists from Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations on down, of course, is that in order for a market to operate, it has to have information. And, of course, Enron is the anti-information. Enron, the information it puts out is incorrect. It's misleading. So there was no defense on the part of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal for duplicity and corruption and financial chicanery because markets cannot operate. They cannot self-correct unless they know what it is that's going on.
What's left of Enron? It still exists?
It's still very much a functioning company. I mean, it's been in bankruptcy for more than a year now, but it still owns utilities, pipelines, power plants, many, many hard assets, although it's no longer in the energy trading business. It still has a book of contracts from that business. So there's a lot of it still there trying to refashion itself into something that will survive, but with a new name.
Yeah, the funny thing about Enron may be in that, you know, after the whole era of Skilling and the creation of the modern Enron, what emerges from bankruptcy is the eventual company may look very much more like the little kind of old state natural gas pipeline company that the company was back in the early 1980s before the great transformation began. So it's almost like Back to the Future. Or future to the back,
or ashes to ashes, dust
to
right.
dust. But I mean, it's you know, after tooling up this company that was going to be the one of the great paradigms for 21st century business, it may just get back to being a, you know, kind of a staid old natural gas pipeline company.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was great.
John Emshwiler and Rebecca Smith are the authors of the new book, 24 Days. They write for The Wall Street Journal. Coming up, political satirist Bill Maher. This is Fresh Air. My guest is political satirist Bill Maher. His HBO series is back on the air. It's called Real Time with Bill Maher, and like his former ABC series, Politically Incorrect, it features comics, actors, and political experts talking about the issues of the day. It also features an opening monologue by Maher and an interview with a political newsmaker. Friday night on this week's edition, Maher will interview California Governor Gray Davis about the movement to recall him. Maher's book, When You Ride Alone, You Ride with Bin Laden, will be published in paperback next month. Bill Maher, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with your state and the movement to recall Governor Gray Davis. You've said that, you know, one of your new rules is no do-overs. Why are you so opposed to the idea of the recall movement?
First of all, when did it become my state?
You live there.
I'm not going to take responsibility for everything that goes on in California. Come on.
I didn't say you owned it.
I know. As I said in the editorial that ran in our local paper, my local paper, the LA Times, basically what happened was the economy turned, so we're getting rid of the governor. And that just doesn't seem fair. I mean, he may not be the greatest governor in the world, but, this precedent of replacing a governor with a recall when things don't go exactly as you like, I think is pretty dangerous for our country and our democracy. If he ran off with public funds or he got caught with kiddie porn, I can understand having a recall. But what happened out here was the dot-com bubble burst, the airline industry went south, we fought a couple of wars overseas, and Dick Cheney and his pals in the energy industry helped Enron game the energy market out here, and that cost the state billions of dollars. None of that do I attribute directly to Gray Davis. So how, by replacing him with God knows who, because on this recall ballot, it could be anyone, how that's going to actually solve the problems that we have here in California, I don't know.
Oh, you know, your new rule is no do-overs. Do you see the recall of Gray Davis as being part of a larger pattern of trying to get people out of office or change the results of elections?
Well, I was saying that the other night on my show to Alec Baldwin and Christopher Hitchens that between impeachment of Bill Clinton and the Florida 2000 election, it does look like the Republicans sometimes will do anything to win except get the most votes. So I'm not saying directly that there's a conspiracy going on here. I don't think there is. But I do think that they take pride in winning at all costs. And, it is a rough game, politics. But it is also how you play the game, and this is not the way to play it.
It's been reported that your good friend Arianna Huffington, who's also a frequent guest on your show, said that she would consider running. Now, her ex-husband Michael Huffington has already filed to be in the recall election. So, are you trying to convince her to run?
I think I did.
Oh, she's
I talked
going
to her. I talked to her the other day. She'd been trying to get a hold of me. She was traveling, and, you know, the first thing I said was, "Hello, Governor," because what we talked about mostly was that even if she doesn't win, it's just too good an opportunity to present the platform. I was on Larry
King. Oh, and to sell her book. Excuse me for the cynicism. Sorry.
Right. Like Hillary Clinton.
Okay.
Come on. I mean, it's all over selling things. I'm sure I'm selling something. But I think that just as she did very well with her shadow convention a couple of years ago, and if folks don't remember what that was, she came up with a brilliant idea in 2000, which was to have shadow conventions in both of the cities. I think it was Philadelphia for the Republicans, and it was out here for the other party. Okay. So she had a shadow convention, which was the convention where people were talking about those issues that neither party would touch. And I said to her, you know, just the way the shadow convention was for the campaign, for the presidency, this could be the same thing for presenting a platform of issues in a governor's race. And even if you don't win, people will hear it. And I think we agreed on what the platform is generally. I said it the other day on Larry King. He asked me about which candidates I favored. And I said, I'm not crazy about either any of them, because none of them are espousing what I would consider to be an attractive political platform, which would be repealing that huge tax cut for rich people, so we can get the economy back in order, ending the drug war, getting real about the environment, getting real about homeland security the way the Israelis do, and ending corporate welfare. And I think that's about the platform she's going to run on. So it'll be interesting to see if you can run a campaign that's sort of the anti-campaign to the way the rest of the clowns do it.
Will it be a little bit bizarre for her to run against her ex-husband?
I hope we can persuade him to leave the race, because let's face it, he wasn't able to get much traction when he had $30 million behind him in the Senate race almost 10 years ago. I don't see that as anything but sort of a vanity exercise. And I know if he's in it, it's more likely that Ariana will not be in it. And, you know, she's much more serious about politics, I think, than he ever was. Even when he was the front man, everyone knew she was behind it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Maher, and his show Real Time with Bill Maher is on HBO Friday nights. And his book, When You Ride Alone, You Ride with Bin Laden, is going to be published in paperback in September. Last week on your show, you did an interview with Barney Frank, the Democratic congressman who was gay and out of the closet, and former Boston Mayor Ray Flynn, who now runs a Catholic website. And the subject was gay marriage. It was a very interesting interview. I'm wondering what you think, why you think President Bush has taken this time to take a stand on gay marriage and to announce that he's opposed to it and he'd like to see legislation that made it impossible. Why now, do you think?
Well, he's a master of catering to his base. And this is a good red meat issue for Republicans and his base. And I don't think he has much to lose. I don't think he figures that he was going to get a large percentage of the gay vote anyway. I think people pretty much knew where he stood on this to begin with. I guess what he said the other day in his press conference was more specific, but when I heard it, maybe I hadn't heard him say those exact words before, but I certainly wasn't surprised. I didn't go like, oh my gosh, George Bush is against gay marriage? Wow. Boy, knocked me over with a feather. I would never have guessed that. He just seems like the kind of guy who wants everything to be fabulous. No, so, you know, he's a very traditional guy, and this is, I guess, his way of signaling to that base that he has not lost his marbles, even though the Supreme Court has made a couple of liberal decisions lately, and maybe he's done a few things that move to the center. This is an easy way for him politically to corral the people who he more than anything wants in his camp, because I think paramount in his mind is the memory of his father losing that base and then losing the election.
At the same time, I'm sure you've been observing the Democratic hopefuls trying to deal with the issue. What do you make of how they're handling it?
Lamely, probably, as always. You know, the Democrats' problem on issues like this is more that they tend to appear to be pandering to special interests, and they shouldn't. But if I was, someone who could make policy and make a speech in a political race, I would keep it real and say, this is such a non-issue, because the only reason we're arguing about whether gay people have the right to be like everybody else is because of what it says in the Bible. And the last time I checked, we had separation of church and state. So it really shouldn't matter what it says in the Bible. And everybody quotes it. Ray Flynn did the other night, and the president did. It says in Scripture. Well, I don't happen to believe in Scripture. It shouldn't even be brought up in this discussion. It's the year 2003. Anyone who thinks gay people are somehow faking it or choosing it, that's just brainwashing from their religious upbringing.
Now, some people who have strong beliefs, as you inarguably do, like to stick with people who share their beliefs. And you're making a career out of having guests on your show who really disagree with you, as well as guests who agree with you. but a lot of them really disagree with you.
Yeah.
So you're kind of setting yourself up for, you know, political aggravation every time you do a show.
Right.
Does that get to you? You're setting yourself up for a fight every time you go on the air.
Well, sure. I mean, otherwise the show would not be that interesting. But it is only an hour a week. I mean, that's fine with me. What I don't like is when people think outside the realm of the television studio that I always want to do what I'm doing on the air. And lots of people think that. Lots of people think, oh, good, there's Bill Maher. I bet you he wants to have a political discussion. And I tell them, no, I'm having a drink in a bar, and I don't.
Well, I think we should talk more about politics. On the other hand, I really want to know what you think of Queer Eye for the Straight Guy.
Well, I actually think it's a good trend, because American men, heterosexual American men in general, do need a massive makeover. You know, sometimes somebody will ask me, what's your secret with women? And I always say, other men. Because just look at them, you know? They're wearing Dockers and polo shirts in a nightclub, and they're wondering why they're going home alone. You know, they just, at a certain point, men in this country just, they lost a huge sense of style. I mean, I really don't know what it was like in other eras, but I just have a feeling that people in the 40s and the 50s and so forth, men used to wear hats and ties, and they just had more of a sense of style. It just seems that men completely gave up. You either became gay, in which you had all the style, or you were straight and you had none. You didn't mind going out in the shirt that was, you know, had a spaghetti stain on it, that you were just watching the football game in. And that was sort of a badge of honor. It sort of meant you were a man. Nothing gay about me. I dressed like an idiot and a slob. So, yes, men, you know, the regular average guy in this country does need a makeover by gay guys. So I think it's good.
My guest is satirist Bill Maher. His show Real Time with Bill Maher is shown Friday nights on HBO. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is satirist Bill Maher. His series, Real Time, is shown Friday nights on HBO. Now, on your show, you've been functioning as
thank you.
as a journalist as well as a comic, because in each show, you on Friday nights, you open up with an interview, usually with somebody in politics.
Right.
You know, recently you've had on Barney Frank, Ray Flynn.
Bob Graham.
And, you ask them questions, and, you're funny when you're asking questions, but still you're asking sometimes tough questions that they have to respond to. I thought I'd play a little excerpt of your interview with Bob Graham and then talk with you about how this worked. Now, Bob Graham is former chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, and he was the head of the committee while the report on intelligence was being issued, the report on 9/11.
Right.
So you were talking to him about that report and about how much of it was blacked out.
Right.
So let's play an excerpt of that interview.
Okay.
Well, and look, we are thrilled to have you because you are the man on today's front page of every paper. This is your report from your committee. Now, a lot of it was censored. A lot of it was blacked out. I know how that feels. I used to work at ABC. But the parts of the report where somebody went through it with a black Sharpie and blacked it out. Now, come on, it's just you and me. What's in the blackout? What does the blacked out part say?
Well, first, Bill, I am running for president of the United States. I don't want to take a detour to the federal penitentiary. The parts that were blacked out have primarily a focus on a foreign government that was providing direct assistance to some of the hijackers. And I think the administration felt it would be too embarrassing to our relationship with this foreign government, even though they had been part of a conspiracy that ended up with 3,000 Americans killed. There also are some references to federal agencies and people in those agencies, which would have been embarrassing. And finally, by keeping these pages blanked out, the American people won't be able to ask the kind of probing questions that they
right.
should of how this administration and our intelligence community has handled its responsibilities to secure the people of America.
All right, so we cannot name this country, but it is, we can assume, a veritable Mecca of terrorist activity.
That's Bill Maher with Senator Bob Graham from Bill Maher Show Real Time on HBO. And that was the first episode of this part of the season, which was broadcast on July 25th. So, Bill Maher, what's it like for you to talk to, Senator Graham about this? He knows that you know that he's talking about Saudi Arabia in this report. You know that he knows that you know. And yet you know that you're not going to get him to tell you that, yes, it's Saudi Arabia. So there's a little dance that's going on. You all know the steps, but you have to do that dance anyways.
Well, that particular interview, because of what you just described, the silly fandango we were doing about Saudi Arabia, was perfect for a comedy show. I can't think of a better scenario for a comedian to be introduced to be interviewing a politician than this silly, silly exercise that he was forced to go through where he can't say the name of the country. It was like an Abbott and Costello sketch. I mean, you can't write stuff like that. That's just a gift, when you're given a gift like that. But I hope that even though we were mocking it, and it certainly deserved to be mocked, I hope people who were not that up on the news and hadn't been following the story got the basic idea of what was going on here. That a report had been commissioned on 9/11, and when it came out, the stuff on the key country, Saudi Arabia, was blacked out, and basically so was the man's voice. I mean, he literally couldn't say it. I mean, nothing to me makes the point better than that about our sad and starry state of being beholden to this country, which is responsible more than any other for 9/11 and terrorist activity in general, I believe.
Janine Garofalo, who I think is a friend of yours,
yeah,
who's a comic and was one of the people from the entertainment world who weighed in on the war with Iraq before the war started. She strongly opposed the war. She became a real target for people on the right who who thought that, you know, not only was she politically wrong, but where does she get off? You know, isn't it ridiculous for, you know, someone from showbiz to be having a forceful opinion like this? What was it like for you to watch her being attacked in the way that she was? And I think she was really singled out for attack.
Right. Well, any of us who were against the war, and myself included, were called traitors by certain people. I saw my picture and name in certain scurrilous, tabloidy type places, along with pictures of Janine and Martin Sheen and Tim Robbins, and, you know, we, the people who, as I like to say, cannot mentally walk and chew gum at the same time, who could not get it through their very thick skull that being against the war did not mean you were for Saddam. But Janine, who, by the way, I think will be on our show Friday, I think it's Janine and Donna Brazil are there Friday, she had a certitude about the folly of going to war that I personally did not possess at all. I, to this day, think the jury is out on whether it was a good idea to go into a country that was not involved with terrorism to fight a war on terror. However, I did make the point over and over again that I was 60-40 on the situation. I don't know. Maybe it will work. And now that we've done it, I keep telling people over and over again, you know, you got to root for the plan. It may have been Bush's war, but it's America's peace. And people should not root against it. But neither should they have castigated Janine and people like her for basically just having a disagreement on the technique of fighting the war on terror.
One last question, and we only have a few seconds left, so I need a kind of quick answer to this
one. Okay.
What does it say to you that Hillary Clinton and your good friend and frequent guest Ann Coulter are both on the bestseller list?
That we live in a diverse country and these are diverse times.
Okay.
You said quick.
You could say a couple of seconds more than that. If you had
people love blondes.
Okay. Bill Maher, thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. It's always a pleasure.
Bill Maher's HBO series Real Time is shown Friday nights. His book, When You Ride Alone, You Ride with Bin Laden, will be published in paperback next month. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harper Business, publisher of The Intelligent Investor by Benjamin Graham, Principles for Value Investing, newly updated by Jason Zweig, and with a preface by Warren Buffett. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actress Hope Davis. She starred in About Schmidt and Next Stop Wonderland. She's starring in two new films, The Secret Lives of Dentists and American Splendor. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.